Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I'm Ken Levine, your podcast host. This is part two of my two-part interview with Jeffrey Sweet, who wrote a terrific book called Something Wonderful Right Away. If you missed part one after you listen to this, go back and check that out. Topic, comedy, and it turns out that it wasn't invented in 2007. You know, you can go back and you go back here to the 50s and the rich vein of comedy that sprung up from improvisation. Well, we're going to talk more and more about that. Part two with Jeffrey Sweet. And again, his book is Something Wonderful Right Away, which he has updated. It's a brand new version that is coming out right now. And you can get it at a bookstore if you can find a bookstore, and of course also on Amazon. So here you go, part two with Jeffrey Sweet right now on Hollywood and Levine. But when I say Nicholson May sort of changed comedy in the 60s, would you agree?
Oh, yeah. For one thing, they were talking about stuff that nobody, I mean, it's hard for us, you know, jaded out there, free, liberated spirits to realize, but people really didn't talk overtly about sex in comedy routines. This is something that Jules Pfeiffer observed, that when he saw Nicholson May on TV doing the teenager scene where he's, you know, he's trying to get her to sleep with him. He was shocked. He had never seen anything like that before. And he said, well, these are my people. And then he, you know, they all became friends and collaborators. But he said, you know, today you wouldn't realize that this would be subject matter that that back in the 50s, nobody would deal with directly. You know, that wonderful line, she says, you know, let's say I do this, you know. Would you still like me? He says, I'd like you like crazy. She says, are you sure you wouldn't just be grateful? He says, no, really, you know, like.
If you're saying anything, yeah.
Yeah, like crazy.
And why did their relationship break up?
Here's the interesting thing is that when I was interviewing Mike, back before some of the recordings that were eventually dug up, like he told me that the teenager scene was never recorded, and he was wrong because they dug up a video of it and we all now have access to it now. He gave me the stage manager's prompt script, which was a transcript of the show. And I thought, oh, great. There are going to be scenes in here that I'm going to laugh my ass off that, you know, I've never heard before. It wasn't funny on the page. It was all behavior. There are very few jokes in Nicholson May. It's all behavior and intonation.
It's all out of character. Yeah. Yeah. Why did they break up?
They broke up. Well, they were doing their stage show together on Broadway and was running for a year. They were selling out. They were doing great. And she was going crazy because she hated repeating scenes. It just bored the crap out of her. She didn't want to. She was making a lot of money and she was doing well, but it just was boring to her to get on stage every night for a year and do the same damn scenes over and over. And so she pulled the plug on the show because she just couldn't take it anymore. And then she wrote a play and cast him in the play, and the play wasn't working. And he told her she'd written the play wrong, and she told him that he was fucking up her script. and they stopped talking for a while. You know, she tried to get him fired, and he tried to get somebody else to come in and fix the show, and they betrayed each other, he said. And he said that kind of ruined things. And then for a few years, they didn't have much contact, and then they just came back together.
Life's too short.
Yeah, and they found new ways to work together. So she wrote screenplays for him, and you know, they would like at Carter's inaugural, they did a performance for Carter's inaugural. I happened to see them when they acted together in a stage production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at Long Wharf. They couldn't keep away from each other, and they fed each other, and they loved each other in a way that the people who collaborate and bring the best out of each other love each other. I'm sure that you feel that way with your partner, that it's a kind of marriage, and that you speak a shorthand, and there's a kind of affection that you have with a real tight writing partner.
Very, very much so. Very much so. You were able to get Mike Nichols to do your interview.
Yeah.
You were not able to get Elaine May.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Well, Elaine's very private, and she knows that she's sort of eccentric, I think, and she doesn't want people talking about her or writing about her. She doesn't want anything any image of her out there that she doesn't control. You know, when she does these speeches on awards nights or something, she's controlling that, and she's brilliant. But she didn't want, and she actively called people up and said, you know, don't cooperate with this guy. And Mike, who enjoyed talking to me, once I'd interviewed him, he called up everybody and said, pay no attention to Elaine. This guy's okay. Talk to him. So, mm-hmm. So it's, I'll tell you a story that's not in the book. There was a memorial for one of the people in the book, a wonderful woman named Bobby Gordon, a woman who was in the Compass Players. And I arranged a memorial at New Dramatists, which is a theater in New York. And Mike and Elaine came, and Stiller and Mira came. And there was a point where somewhere along the line, almost everybody who got up and talked about Bobby nodded towards me, because I had created something called the New York Writers Block, which was a group of writers, actors, and directors who got together weekly for 11 years. And we helped each other build stuff. Stiller and Mirror were members of that group too. Anyway, at the evening of this wonderful ceremony, which everybody, you know, told these wonderful stories about this marvelous woman, Barbara Gordon, Elaine comes up to me, because everybody's nodded to me, and said, this group of yours sounds fabulous. She says, can I join it? And I said, well, we lasted for 11 years, and then we disbanded because, you know, people moved into different places and, you know, their careers. She says, well, if you ever get something like this started again, she said, I'd really like to be part of a group like that. What's your name? And I said, Elaine, it's Jeff Sweet. And she said, oh, I tried to sabotage your book, didn't I? And I said, yes, Elaine. She went, toodaloo, and went off down the street. You know, and she used that word. She said, I tried to sabotage your book, didn't I? And I just, yeah, yes, Elaine, you did. You did try to sabotage my book.
I remember Chip Zine telling me the story that he was in, I think it was The Country Girl, the play on Broadway that Mike Nichols directed.
Yeah.
And they had the opening night party at Tavern on the Green.
Yeah.
And Chip goes to a table with his food and sits down and feels there's like something under the table. And he peers under the table, and Mike and Elaine are sitting under the table. just talking. They don't want to be bothered by anybody, so they camped out just under a table.
I absolutely believe it. You know, she's I've had private conversations with her. You know, I mean, she hasn't quite frisked me to find out if there's I had a recorder on me or I was wired or something. But I've had, you know, very pleasant private conversations with her. But I know that she participated in a triple bill of one acts off Broadway that was directed by a British director, and the British director wrote this account of doing that for the New Yorker, and she went nuts about it. She felt betrayed by him because he depicted some of her private behavior. Nothing outrageous. It's just she felt that that was violated, that that was sacrosanct. What happened in, this, you know, like the confessional. You don't you don't tell that stuff. What goes on in a rehearsal room? So as long as she can control her image, fine. But she didn't want to. She didn't want to talk to me for the record, and that's a big lack. I tried to talk to Melinda Dillon. She wouldn't talk to me for the record. I thought she was a genius and one of the great performers out of Second City. But although, but she wouldn't talk for the record. There were a couple of other people. There was a marvelous musician, jazz pianist named Fred Kaz. Do you know about Fred Kaz?
I know the name.
Well, Fred Kaz is a pianist. Get this: in two separate accidents in his in his garage, he two separate times he sawed off fingers. A pianist.
Okay.
You know, in his left hand, which, you know, changed how he played bass notes and bass lines. And he was still a brilliant jazz pianist, but he had, you know, he had three fingers on his left hand because of accidents, you know, with a saw. Anyway, I interviewed him, and talking to him, it all made sense. And when I did a transcript, it was like trying to transcribe bebop. None of it made sense. I just couldn't put it on the page and have anybody know what any of it meant, you know. You know, with him looking sincerely at you, and it, you know, I got it. I grok you, if you remember grok.
Yeah, try having a conversation with Judd Hirsch.
Okay.
You have no idea. He just bounces from topic to topic in the middle of things.
I worked with him a couple of times, you know.
Yeah,
he did a reading of the Value of Names and was wonderful. And I produced an audio version of Hot Hell Baltimore, which is what it was his breakthrough. He was, you know.
Could you understand him when you had a conversation? Were you able to actually have a conversation with him?
Yes, but we were problem solving specific moments. I just loved his enthusiasm. But yeah, the one
he's a great guy.
Yeah. The one who zoomed all over the room when I talked to him was at one point, for reasons I've never been able to figure out, William Hurt called me up like at 11 o'clock at night and talked for an hour. And it was like I was getting signals from Saturn or something, you know. He just made two movies and he was unhappy with movies. And, you know, and he wanted to talk about, you know, the art of the theater. And somebody had touted me as being a fellow idealist. I said maybe five words during the whole conversation. But he talked to me for an hour about art and passion and theater and about the sellouts and film and this and that and the other. I still have no fucking idea why he called me or how he got my number.
You mentioned that there were some disagreements between people. Robert Klein and David Steinberg didn't get along, did they?
No. They have since finally made up. You know, Steinberg has got a podcast series, and he invited Klein on, and they basically said, "We didn't like each other back then, did we?" No, what a waste. And Klein says, "Yeah, well, to be honest, you were kind of a prick to me." And Steinberg says, "Yeah, I was kind of a prick to you," you know. And they sit and joke, but the story goes that at the 50th reunion, they showed up and looked at each other and said, "We've both gotten where we wanted to go. This is a waste. We admire each other's work. Let's be friends." And they just decided to be friends. But Steinberg had a tendency to use other people on stage as props. He knew where he wanted to go, and other people were tools to get where he wanted to go. And that really isn't the Second City ethic, but he held on at Second City because he was so damn funny. It was him and Klein and the wonderful late lamented Fred Willard.
Fred, if you don't get along with Fred Willard, there's something wrong with you. Yeah. The nicest guy in the world.
Wonderful, wonderful human being. Fred could do a scene with anybody. And also, Fred had such a good nature that if Steinberg turned him into a prop in the scene, he would be the best damn prop he could be. Mm-hmm. He just would meet you wherever, whereas Klein knew what was going on. He knew that what Steinberg was doing to him. If you entered a scene, Steinberg put you in a chair, and then he would swarm around you and steal all the focus. And Steinberg, I talked to him. I said to him in one of the interviews, I said, Klein, you know, gives you kind of a hard time. He says, well, yeah, those were my asshole years. You know, Steinberg said this about himself. You know, these were my asshole years.
So, who are some of the names that we should know because of their contribution, but we don't? You know, you throw names like Del Close and Paul Sills. Who are some people and what did they contribute? Why should we know them?
Well, one guy is Andrew Duncan. You may know Andrew Duncan if you know the film Slapshot, because the first scene in Slapshot is Andrew being hilarious as sort of a third-rate newscaster with a bad toupee, talking to a hockey player who's demonstrating all the things you must never do on the ice and demonstrating them on Andrew and bruising the shit out of him as Andrew's trying to create. And that was developed out of an improv. But Andrew was one of the few early players who wasn't Jewish. And that was important because they used non-Jewish people in Second City as the straight people, as the people who represented the establishment world, the conventional culture, the Eisenhower perspective, shall we say. And then, you know, you had Alan Arkin and Barbara Harris and Severin Darden and all these wonderful people who were Jewish. And they would come in and bounce off of and be in subtle antagonism with the dominant culture. So Arkin told me, you know, at one point, everybody went on vacation. And every time somebody was going on vacation, they would say, oh, the show's going to fall apart because Barbara's going or Severin's going or so and so and so. He said, the show was always fine. He says, the show fell apart when Andrew Duncan left, because he established the reality that we needed for the rest of the show. And without him there, there was nothing to bounce off. And he was really the glue of the company. And we discovered he was the most valuable player of the company because he made the rest of the show possible. Yet nobody knew him. The New York Times didn't even run an obit for him, which is like, you know, running an obit for Ringo or something. You know, it drove me nuts. I sometimes hector the Times obit department to the point where I have sort of a relationship with them. Like if I write to them and say, you've missed somebody, they actually sometimes pay attention and run a piece, but I couldn't get them to budge on Andrew Duncan. And Andrew was a key figure in the Compass and a key figure at Second City. He established most of the interviewing conventions because he was always the interviewer and he knew how to set people up brilliantly. You know, he performed the function that Carl Reiner performed for Mel Brooks. He was a great interviewer, and he was a great straight man who couldn't believe what these crazy Jews were doing. Now Second City, you know, is no longer a Jewish theater. It's very diverse, but in its first 10 years or so, it was predominantly part of that wave of Jews who were part of the satire boom that reacted against McCarthyism in the 50s. You know, Philip Roth and Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce and Tom Lehrer and Stan Freeberg, all these people who I think, I don't think it's any accident that satire boomed in the 50s. And I think it was very much a reaction against McCarthyism and the anti-Semitism of the McCarthy era. I think this is their way of getting back at them. So anyway, yes, Andrew Duncan would certainly be one of those people. Severin Darden is known within the improv community as a god. Nobody outside the improv community has the slightest idea of who he was.
I can tell you that firsthand because we used him. He guested one week on Cheers. Mm-hmm. And I was blown away. Like, oh my God, Severin Darden. I got to meet Severin Darden and talk to Severin Darden. And again, nobody else. It was just some schmuck that, you know, he hired, you know, as a guest star this week.
Severin and Peter Cook were the two most original comic minds that I have met. You could never guess where the joke was coming from with them. Usually when you're talking to somebody, you know the logic of their humor and you kind of get the path that there mm-hmm. is. Severn, you could never guess where the joke was coming from. Mike Nichols used to carry in his wallet a line that Severn improvised when he was playing. Severn would sometimes come out and be he would say, "Okay, I'm an expert. What am I expert in?" And somebody would shout up something, and then he would be interviewed as that expert. And there's one point when he was an art expert, and he was talking about how there was a certain point when perspective was introduced in painting. He says, you know, the old Egyptian paintings are all two-dimensional. The eyes are like that, you know, like, mm-hmm. They're two-dimensional. He said, and then we found perspective in art. And the interviewer said, "Why is that?" And he says, "Well, that's when we entered three dimensions." He says, "Before that, we lived a flat life." He says, "We, the universe is constantly expanding. We expanded to three dimensions. That's my perspective." You can't anticipate a joke like that. That's too good a joke.
And Nichols kept that in his pocket as an example of what?
Well, no, the line he kept in his pocket was when he was playing a marine biologist, and he said, Severn said, of motion, the oyster has but a dim racial memory.
What?
And Nichols,
you're right. That's not the standard line somebody would come up with off the top of his head.
And Nichols said, whenever I got depressed, he said, I'd look at this line and say, I knew a man who was capable of coming up with this line spontaneously. And isn't the world a glorious place sometimes after all? It's the thing that got him out of depression, he said, was to realize that he knew a man who was able to come up with a line like that out of nowhere, you know. But, you know, Peter Cook, we used to do this sometimes, too. Do you remember the old routine where he's playing classical music on his phonograph, and Dudley Moore comes in and Moore says, "What is that?" And Cook says, that's classical music. That's music what has aspirations. Oh, is it really? Yes. This is a piece by French impressionistic composer Debussy. He's painting a picture with music. This particular piece is called La Mer. Yes, he's painting a picture of music. Why, if you close your eyes, you can almost see Debussy's mother wheeling in the tea trolley. You can't anticipate a joke like that.
I know. I love that. I absolutely love that. The humor seems to have changed, as you mentioned, to reflect the times. And I go to improv shows now,
yeah,
and I find there's like a lot of energy, yeah, among the Gen Zs and millennials who are doing it. It's primarily pop culture.
Yeah. That's the audience. That's what the audience knows.
Yeah.
Keegan, Michael Key, in the new interview, in the new edition of the book, said that he's a big history maven. And when they were doing Key and Peele, he kept wanting to doing scenes that had some history content. He says, you know, if Hugh Laurie could do a thing about the Treaty of Ghent, you know, why couldn't we do a scene about, you know? And everybody would look at him and say, Keegan, nobody understands the reference. Nobody will get it. You can do a great scene about Massasoit, and nobody's going to know who Massasoit is, you know? And it's true. He's, you know, our culture does not have the same awareness of history that the Brits do. You know, the Brits are brought up with all this history around them and all this classical theater, which celebrates their history. We don't have those references. So we reference something else. And it's a shame. There is, however, still some great character-based improv out there. TJ and Dave are bloody brilliant. Two guys who, without taking a suggestion from the audience or consulting with each other at all, the lights come up. They've arbitrarily placed the chair somewhere on the stage. So one of them says something almost arbitrarily, and by the end of an hour, they've created maybe a dozen characters, several plot lines, and it's themes are established. The acting is brilliant. And it's improvisation on about as high a level as you can get. And they never advertise. They don't have to. They simply announce that they're doing a show and they're instantly sold out. They also have great understudies. TJ and Dave's understudies are Tracy Letts and Michael Shannon.
Wow.
I once went
and,
I once,
and I've never heard of these two guys. What does that say? That these guys are the most brilliant improvisers on the planet at the moment, and they're doing it in relative obscurity.
Well, but they just did a weekend here in New York. They sold out all four shows instantly. They're going to do a weekend in Chicago. That'll be sold out. They did a film called Trust Us, This Is All Made Up, which you can rent from Amazon Prime, which is of one of their performances at the Barrow Street Theater. They can't do a regular run because, as you might imagine, doing an hour-long new play every night takes it out of you. And they can do about four of these in a row without being exhausted. And then it's so they could never do a conventional run. But they got extraordinary reviews out of the New York Times, out of a lot of other places. Colbert says of them, one of these guys is the best improviser in the world, and the other guy is even better. it's not joke. It's slow improv. It's real characterization, and it's real acting. These guys are just brilliant, bloody actors, and they spontaneously come up with amazing material. But the audience, it's fascinating because one person will say one thing, the other guy will say something that is consistent with the first thing but add something new, and they'll keep going until the point where all of a sudden you almost hear a click and they know what the scene is. They know what they're playing, who they are, and what the stakes are. And their audiences are sometimes so sophisticated that the audience applauds that click, that the audience goes, oh, they know what the scene is, and they will applaud the click, the lock, as I call it. I've never told them that I call it the lock. Next week, I'm seeing Dave, and we'll talk about it. You and I have had conversations about this before, but I'm a great believer that improvisational theory and playwriting theory are closely allied, that a lot of the things that make a good improv scene can be turned into things that will make a good play or film or TV script. So, and in fact, in full disclosure, you are a member of our online improv for playwriting.
That's true.
We meet once a month and we improvise off of each other's premises and help each other jumpstart new scenes and new stuff.
It's also one of the reasons why David and I, the way we write is we dictate to a writer's assistant.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times we're just improvising.
Well,
you know, it allows us the freedom to not just sit there and go line by line where this line has to be perfect before you can get to the next line. A lot of times we'll just riff and then we'll just go back and clean it up. But it's all improv.
Well, that's how the screenplay of Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice was written, mostly over a weekend with Paul Mazursky and Larry Tucker. They come from Second City. In fact, Paul Mazursky did a movie called Alex in Wonderland, an autobiographic movie, and he hired Viola Spolin to play his mother, which pissed off his mother. You put me into a movie and you hire this person nobody's ever heard of to play me? Couldn't you get a fucking star to play me? You're my son. You're a movie director.
Oh, I thought she was going to want to play herself.
No, she wanted a movie star to play her. Anyway, eventually, you know, Mazursky did indeed put up another movie, which his mother was in. It was called Next Stop Greenwich Village. And he had Shelley Berman playing his mother, but his mother had died by then. given the portrait of his mother, not Shelley Berman. Come on now. Shelley Winters.
Shelley Winters, yeah.
Shelley Winters. Wrong Shelley. But Shelley Winters playing, and given how obnoxious the Shelley Winters character is as opposed to, you know, dignified Viola Spolin, I sort of think that maybe Mazursky's mother might have cut him a break posthumously. But yeah,
she wanted Shelley Long.
Oh, I'm sure, and Shelley Long would have been a marvelous mama. Of course, Shelley Long is another Second City person.
That's right.
I watched those early episodes of Cheers, and everybody's good. She, as a technician, is astonishing. The clarity and the intelligence and the precision of that playing is a jaw dropping. I don't think people knew how brilliant a technician she was as a performer.
Oh, I always maintained anyone other than Shelley in that show goes 13 weeks.
She was
that good. Such a difficult character to play because it would be so easy to hate her.
Yeah.
And yet you didn't. She walked that fine line. Well, lots and lots of people came out of Second City. Let's just do a little name dropping. As you mentioned, Robert Klein, Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, Alan Alda, Alan Arkin, Ed Asner, Barbara Harris,
Melinda Dillon.
Melinda Dillon. What 500 other people am I leaving out?
Megan Fay, Amy Poehler, Andrea.
Tina Fey. Yeah. Gilda Radner. John Belushi.
Andrea Martin, Martin Short, Dan Aykroyd,
John Candy.
Yeah. I mean, it's an astonishing group of people. They're a team who were big in their day and have been forgotten now, but I thought were absolutely brilliant. And they played Broadway and had specials on TV. The team of John Monteith and Suzanne Rand, who were absolutely brilliant and were like a comet that flared through the sky and have largely been forgotten. But they were so good that for a while, Leonard Bernstein went around town wearing a Monteith and Rand show jacket. He was such a fan of theirs.
Wow. Stiller and Mira. Two more.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a group. And the great pleasure in Richard Kind, who was in one of my shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, one of the great pleasures for me is I ended up working with some of these people. Shelley Berman starred in my play, The Value of Names, in Chicago, and actually reestablished his acting career doing that. He got rave reviews and then he started being hired as an actor again. So I had the great pleasure of working with a lot of these people, after doing the book. I got to, play a scene once with Ed Asner. That was funny. There was a benefit in Arizona of a Jewish theater in Arizona. And a woman who ran the place, said we'd like to do a benefit. Will you come out and do this benefit? And he says, sure, if you bring Sweet out. So I said, oh, okay. And so it was going to be, and Barbara Harris was living there at the time. So Barbara and Ed and I were going to do this benefit for this Arizona Jewish theater. And these people showed up and we were going to tell them the stories of the origin of Chicago theater. And we ran a clip of Barbara doing a scene with Alan Arkin, and Ed and I were doing a scene from one of my plays called Bluff, and we were rehearsing in the afternoon. He says, stop. He says, I know what you're doing. I said, what am I doing? He says, you're feeding the monster. He says, get your laughs. He says, I can take care of myself. So I wasn't. Okay.
I got to do a scene with Andrea Martin. Yeah, this was 1979, and my partner and I were casting that Nichols and May pilot. We went to New York and we put her on tape and I played opposite her.
Yeah.
And it's nice. I've got this tape of me and Andrea Martin doing a scene together.
She's a bloody genius. I saw her very young when she was very unsure. Now she's, you know, steely and professional. I've run into her since and she's, you know, she's pretty tough now. But when I first met her, she was very insecure, very funny. I saw her once go on stage when she was so tired she didn't know what way was up, and she was still brilliant. It was like there was a gyroscope in her that kept her in true course. She asked me at one point, she says, you're a writer. I said, yeah. She says, well, my boyfriend, whoever the boyfriend at the time was, wants to be a writer. Will you go out to dinner with us and will you tell my boyfriend what it's like to be a writer? So I went out and had dinner with her, and I didn't see her for years and years. Then one day I'm coming down the elevator of my building and I'm looking at my cell phone and I'm seeing news that a director friend of mine has just died. And I went, oh, she and this woman in the elevator says, "What?" And I said, "Oh, this director is a friend of mine, just died." And she says, "Oh, he was a good director." She says, are you in the theater?" I said, "Yeah, I'm a playwright." And she says, "Well, I'm an actor." I said, "Oh, what's your name?" She says, "Andrea Martin." I said, "Andrea?"
Oh, wow.
I hadn't recognized her because she didn't have, you know, her active face on. She was just this middle-aged woman in the elevator. I said, "Andrea," I said, "it's Jeff Sweet." And she says, "Well, why the fuck didn't you recognize me?"
Yeah, she's got a point. So the book is called Something Wonderful Right Away. This is the updated version where we get the perspective of time, and it's available wherever you buy your books, which is like Amazon.
Amazon, Amazon, you know, glad that they're there, but support your local bookstore.
So, I know, yeah, but I'm saying how many bookstores are there? But yes.
The Drama Bookshop.
Go and support your local bookstore.
Amazon will have a Kindle version, an ebook version, and that's the only way to read it on an ebook if you want to read it on an ebook. But, you know, for all of those listening with whom I have a deep and sincere and intimate relationship, you five know who you are. Mm-hmm. please buy a real book in a real bookstore. We need to keep these places alive.
Thank you, Jeff.
And our thanks to Jeffrey Sweet. Again, his book is Something Wonderful Right Away. This is the updated version, and it is available wherever you get books. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister, Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. Come back next week for more excitement here on Hollywood and Levine. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hollywood and Levine.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.